Hi, this is Gabriel Arana, and I'm subbing for Sarah Posner, who's off for the next month. My guest today is Anne Friedman, the executive editor of Tomorrow Magazine. Do you have a title quite yet?
No, I don't.
No.
We're all casual. We don't have titles yet.
Yes. My former colleague at The Prospect, and most recently, the executive editor of Good Magazine. So after Good Magazine laid off its editorial staff and a bunch of her former colleagues decided to start Tomorrow Magazine. And they had a quick Kickstarter, which has been up for, is it 2 weeks now?
About two weeks.
And so far it's raised over $35,000, is that right?
Yeah.
So our first topic today, I wanted to talk to Anne a bit about the concept behind Tomorrow Magazine. Mm-hmm. So tell me about it, Anne.
Well, I mean, obviously, you and all of your colleagues getting fired is not, on its face, the most pleasant story. But when we sat down and talked about what we were actually upset about, other than, you know, having to look for new jobs and being unemployed, it was really that we weren't going to get the chance to work together as this group any longer. And so we kind of came up with this idea to do one last magazine together, and people really responded. It's been so awesome.
So what's the idea about it? What's the idea behind it? So it's called Tomorrow, and the description said it's about what's fresh, what's new. Can you tell me a little bit more about, you know, what you guys are thinking as an overarching concept for it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's born of a couple things. One is that we're not really in love with the ideas issue of a lot of the major magazines, you know, like The Atlantic, The New York Times will do kind of like innovation or what's next issues. And it kind of always seems like the same stuff. It's like, you know, a new type of solar panel and like, you know, maybe we should make all schools charter schools. It's like, you know, it's like honestly like not that exciting. So really part of it is coming from a perspective of wanting to do something that is forward-looking predictive in a way, but not quite so predictable as those things normally are. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that you know, we're really interested in immediately, like what's happening like immediately tomorrow. Like that the name is really appropriate in that sense, not just forward looking rather than backward looking after being fired, but it's also a way to sort of say, okay, you know, like 50 years in the future, 100 years in the future, like the super, super forward-thinking stuff is actually not as exciting as talking about, like, what are we all going to be talking about, you know, next year at this time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that has to do with looking at what's happening in, like, niches and subcultures right now and finding ways to sort of pick out, oh, this is this one aspect of this this niche that's going to be blown out and become mainstream in the next like couple months. Like that's like an exciting endeavor to us. So I think a lot of it is just like an alignment of personal interests with a really nice editorial frame given where we are all at in our careers, plus sort of identifying what we see as like a hole in other editorial media.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that you all spoke about in your opening manifesto project description mm-hmm. was the editorial freedom mm-hmm. That comes with starting your own magazine.
Yeah.
And you having been the executive editor at Good, mm-hmm. what are not so much specific to Good, but what are some of the forces that weigh on creativity, economic as well as institutional?
Well, I mean, look, the way I always kind of put it is like independent magazines, in that magazines that are not owned by one of the big publishing companies, like to sort of say like, oh, you know, you get a totally different perspective, a totally independent perspective. I mean, really, it's like, okay, like either you get something that is skewed to foundations, you get something that is skewed to big donors, or you get something that is like skewed to advertisers. You know, there's really no way to produce media in most media, there's no way to produce it without being beholden to some sort of like bigger entity with an agenda, which is why they're underwriting it and want to be associated with your media. You know, for us, this like crowdsourcing, the funding for this has been really interesting because, you know, the only people we're beholden to are the people who have essentially pre-ordered the magazine, which is really cool. You know, not that we're going to seek to do a bunch of like hit pieces on foundations or corporations. But, you know, it's nice to know that we could, and it's nice to know that like we don't have to edit out like, you know, like swear words, or like we can talk about like sex in an intelligent way, and things that, you know, we definitely did at Good, but, you know, there's a tension there with advertisers who are naturally more conservative than readers. So it's just going to be exciting to not have to worry about anything other than making the best magazine we can make.
That's great. So on to our second topic, and you and I were chatting a bit earlier about how to make topics that are important but dry interesting. So the prime example being campaign finance and money in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two thoughts on that, because I think, one, the problem is that it's hard to make numbers, and especially a lot of numbers, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like it's a data visualization problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I think that part of the reason that people don't respond to campaign finance stories in the way that they respond to stuff, you know, to stories about, say, Mitt Romney's latest gaffe, is that when we're talking about campaign finance, the numbers seem so enormous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you throw out $100 million, or which is approximately what Romney raised this past month,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just such an enormous amount of money that for most people, myself
right.
and yourself included, unless you have a secret stash that nobody knows about, you know, that it's hard to really contextualize that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what does $100 million mean?
Right. And also just where does it go? I mean, I think that it's like, you know, the things that eat up money in a campaign, you know, while there's certainly reporting on, you know, ads and how that money is spent. I haven't yet seen a sort of like, I mean, I hesitate to say like a how the sausage gets made piece, but like a real sort of like, this is like what a campaign budget looks like. And this is where this money is just sort of being like, I mean, where does it go? You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I was listening to a thing on NPR yesterday about the campaign, and they just kind of mentioned in passing, you know, like how the spending keeps going up and up and up for both candidates, and it's just like the poll numbers have not moved on either side. It's just like it's still a dead heat. And I know, obviously, like, you know, I worked in D.C. for a long time. You work there now. It's like, you know, there are reasons why this amount of spending is, you know, necessary to some degree. But I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, it's just, you're totally right in that it's, like, a bunch of zeros problem. You know, your eyes just glaze over. But it's also, like, isn't that the way it always has been, / the way it has to be, defeatism about it that makes it not seem exciting, in that there's no movement on this. There's no, like, groundswell to change any
yeah,
of this
exactly.
process.
Mm-hmm.
So...
I think you're absolutely right. Especially after Citizens United,
mm-hmm.
and given that the Montana Supreme Court's challenge to Citizens United was not reviewed by the Supreme Court. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it sort of feels like there's nothing much we can do about money in politics.
Yep. Yeah, I mean,
so
and I think if Citizens United didn't, like, I mean, look, people, that's, like, a helpful shorthand for this issue, but, you know, if that didn't really, I mean, which is slightly different, obviously, than, like, campaign spending, you know, by candidates, I guess if Citizens United didn't galvanize, you know, voters in this country to really invest in this as an issue and care about it, I don't really know when the next opportunity is going to come for that. I mean, it seemed like that's a pretty a pretty, I don't know, a pretty good crystallization of the money in politics issue. It's got a nice shorthand. It's like, you know, and yet, like, there is no national conversation about this.
Mm-hmm. Do you think data visualization would help?
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of it is, like, not having an alternative. I mean, I thought about this before. It's like, you know, will people say we spend too much? If you took a poll, like, do we spend too much on elections? Do candidates spend too much? Anyone who is vaguely plugged into the news is going to be like, yes, it's we spend entirely too much money, like, electing candidates. And, you know, does too much money flow through Washington? Absolutely. So, you know, in some ways, like, you know, data visualization helps clarify, like, you know, drill down on
the extent
that,
but, of the problem.
Right, but I think that most people kind of understand it's a problem. For me, and this is something that, you know, was really an instructive, like, editorial frame when I worked at Good, is that, you know, well, okay, so we all know this thing is bad, what's the alternative? You know, which is not to say you have to be, like, pie in the sky, weirdly optimistic about its success, but, like, you know, what are the other models? Like, in countries that are, you know, that are also, you know, like, first world economic powerhouses, whatever, do they spend comparable amounts on elections? And if not, why not? And how do they structure their campaigns? I mean, really sort of, like, maybe visualizing that as, like, an alternative, like, this is what we should be asking for, could perhaps be even more helpful than just, like, here's some data on money in politics.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right.
Yeah.
So to end with, we wanted to talk about a more fun, lighthearted topic, although there are serious things to say about it. Do you want to introduce this one, Anne?
Well, maybe I'll use the same frame that you used for our last question, which is, why don't people care more about Magic Mike?
why don't people care more about Magic Mike?
I mean, I'm kidding, obviously. I think that the real question is, why do I find myself caring so much about Magic Mike? I mean, so here's the deal. I don't find Channing Tatum attractive. I don't think that, like, this particular, like, you know, brand of, like, male stripping is sexy. I don't think it was a particularly good movie. And yet I have seen it twice. Explain this to me, Gabe.
I don't know. I mean, are you interested in the audience's reactions?
I mean, that's part of it. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm really interested in how look, obviously most types of sex work are, like, performing sexuality in some way, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that this is really interesting because normally women are performing sexuality and men are sort of, like, the viewers or the recipients of that. And this is men performing sexuality in a pretty mainstream venue, you know, like in movie theaters across America. Like, I think that's fascinating to me. You know, I don't think it's particularly transgressive. I mean, Tracy Clark Flory wrote a piece in Salon about how she's like, can we talk about how male strippers aren't sexy? And I don't think that that's true. I don't think that that's, like, I mean, you know, but I do think that it's definitely more of a joke than it is like, oh my God, I'm getting so turned on right now by these, like, you know, sequined thongs.
Yeah. Although I sort of don't understand why anyone who ever goes to, I mean, a real life strip joint gets turned on. I mean,
sure.
given that it's a public venue and, you know, you're surrounded by so many people.
And this is obviously someone who's paid to perform for you. It's not like they're, like, into you, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally need some reciprocity.
Sure.
So what do you think about the, I guess, the charge that's been levied at the movie that it objectifies men and it's reverse sexism, if you want to call it that?
I mean, so let's be honest. Anytime you're appending reverse to an ism, it's like you're probably wrong. Like, let's just state that, like, up front. You know, and is it, I mean, I don't know. Like, is it objectifying men in that, like, you know, for... I don't know. Yeah, sure. And that, like, the idea of, like, going to, like, just see men gyrate and appreciate the male form, like, that is totally objectification. That is the definition of objectification. Mm-hmm. Does like, Magic Mike objectify men? I mean, we're supposed to care deeply about Channing Tatum's furniture business. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I would say that, like, not entirely. You know, it's not like he's just sort of, it's not like, you know, we're just going to watch, like, you know, the exquisite male stripper review, like, without any sort of plot or anything attached to it. I guess I just sort of am like, you know, I did a silly little pie chart about Magic Mike for the hairpin, and one of the commenters said something about how, like, you know, so wait, this movie utterly fails to reverse, like, centuries of the male gaze. That doesn't seem very magic to me, Mike. And so I think that it can be true that it's both, it is both, like, somewhat objectifying to men, and also it's not reverse anything or any sort of step forward.
Yeah, see, I think that there's a difference because, you know, while in the strict sense it might objectify men, you know, men don't face the same day-to-day constant mm-hmm. objectification. The fact that this is a movie about...
In most neighborhoods in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
I say this in Palm Springs right now. I'm like, in most parts of America.
Well, one thing that was funny is I was reading the New York Times article about how the movie's a big hit with gay men. And mm-hmm. if there's... Whenever I talk to somebody who's straight who's complaining about feminism, I always point out that gay men will often objectify men in the way that they objectify women. And, I mean, like, as you know, people have, you know, gay panic when that happens. So, I mean, I always say that as a way to try to make them understand that, you know, they shouldn't, you know, that they don't have to be okay with being objectified, and, mm-hmm. You know, they should understand when other people aren't either.
So you use homophobia to your argumentative advantage, is that what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I think that I was saying to a friend last night that how I can't figure out why I'm actually fascinated by this movie, and he was like, I think that's just every Steven Soderbergh movie. I think it's like actually a filter Steven Soderbergh applies where you're like, this should be really boring, and I actually didn't like it that much, but I keep talking about it.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, maybe that's it.
Uh-huh. Have you gone to see it with friends?
Well, so the first time I saw it, I've seen it twice, as I confessed. The first time I saw it, it was at a 21-plus screening where they served booze on a Sunday night. And it was a packed theater of all mostly women and, like, a smattering of gay men. And it was amazing. Like, it was just, like, so much hooting. Mm-hmm. At one point, there was a... like a dialogue sequence that was like not a dance scene, and a woman sitting next to us just goes boring. I appreciated that, and then I saw it a second time because another crew of lady friends was going and they were like, you have to go, and I was like, this is shameful to see it a second time, but okay. And it was a much more subdued theater and it was remarkably less fun.
Mm-hmm.
But the theater going experience, I gotta figure out when. I think that like early Sunday night showing with, like, you know, a good, like, girls' night out, like, not a date night, a ladies' night on a Sunday, get a babysitter or leave your kids with your husband kind of screening was where it was at.
Maybe it can become like a new Rocky Horror.
Oh my God! Don't even. That sounds delightful. That sounds delightful. Yeah, I love it. It needs a little bit more dance, and then I think we're there.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on, Anne, and thanks for everyone watching.
Thanks for having me, Gabe.
All right.